Hello, everybody, and welcome to That Millennial Life, a podcast where I talk to millennials about their lives and how they are managing young adulthood. I'm currently sitting in a hotel room in Arlington, Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C., with my friend Mustafa El Agar. I decided to come down here to interview a guest I wanted to have on the podcast who works down here named Lexi Gruber. Mustafa is down here in D.C. for work for the week, so I figured I'd utilize that so I don't have to come down here by myself. You're in D.C. this week, and then where are you going after?
Is this the part where I talk?
Yeah, you can if you
I'm
want.
I'm allowed to?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I am here for regional sales training for three of the regions of Ethicon Salesforce, so I'm helping out.
And then where are you going after?
And then I'm going to Tampa
for the
Florida
Frozen Four.
Go Bobcats.
Yeah.
Oh, it's going to be so friggin' awesome. I don't want to take up your podcast, but
yeah, good luck
really
to them
for that. Yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, like I said, today on the podcast, I will be talking to a young woman named Lexi Gruber. If you have listened to the previous episodes of my podcast, you may have heard an episode, episode 26 to be exact, where I talked about her and talked about some of my opinions about political correctness and its connection to the millennial generation. I suggest to anyone listening to this to listen to that podcast first so that some of the things that we talk about specifically in the following conversation will have context. Like I said, episode 26. I usually have short introductions where it's just me talking, not me talking to a guest yet, but in that episode I talked by myself about Lexi and those other topics I mentioned for much longer because I felt I wanted to give my opinion about certain issues involving her in the Quinnipiac community, Quinnipiac University being, like we said, where I went to college. So that's really all I want to say about the conversation you're about to hear, and I hope you enjoy it. But before I get to the conversation, I want to implore people, anyone who's listening, to go to www.gofundme.com/bobcatsfightcancer and donate to a cause that my friend and past guest Tammy Nguyen is attempting to raise money for. There is a young woman named Corey Burke who is a junior at Quinnipiac who recently was diagnosed with metastatic cancer. I don't know her too well. I've only met her once or twice, but from what I hear, she is just as beautiful of a person inside as she is on the outside, which is apparent, the outside part, very beautiful. it's just so sad that someone who was so close to finishing her college education is now going through this. So like I said, if you're willing, please donate to www.gofundme.com/bobcatsfightcancer. I'll post the link on the That Millennial Life Facebook page when I post the link for the episode. Tammy is running 2 half marathons in her honor and is attempting to raise money for Corey and her family. So if you can, please help out. It'd be really appreciated. And I really hope Corey gets better. And I'm sure, Stav, you share those sentiments.
Yeah. I do, of course. I mean, I wouldn't wish anything else but to want that than the other than the best for her. And also, I do want to give a shout out to one of our friends' little brother too, who's also going through cancer, who's a freshman at Quinnipiac, Nick Campanella. So to Corey and Nick, prayers from everyone in the Quinnipiac community, and we wish you the best. Good luck and. We're going to keep you in our prayers and thoughts.
Yeah. Thanks, Dobby. But anyway, like I said, I came down to the DC area to talk to Lexi. So let's now go to the conversation I had with Lexi Gruber. Okay. Hello, everybody. My name is Joe Cole. I am sitting in a hotel room with Lexi Gruber in Arlington, Virginia.
Yes.
Right? That's where we are?
Right outside Washington, D.C.
Yeah. And, first of all, you told me that, you can't necessarily, talk about, what you're doing here. Did you say that?
No, actually, I have a new position.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that I start tomorrow.
Cool. Can you talk about like why, what the work you're doing here?
Sure.
Is?
So in my new position?
Yeah.
So I'm going to be working with the American Public Human Services Association, which is located in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And we represent the commissioners of state public human service agencies around the country before Congress and the administration. So in my position, I'm going to be working on child welfare and child care.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to be working on lobbying on behalf of the heads of those agencies before Congress and the administration and just doing what we can until, you know, to get their interests across.
Wow.
Yeah.
So important stuff.
For sure.
That's crazy. So how long did you come out here, like right after graduation?
I moved to D.C. pretty much 2 weeks before graduation, like right after finals. And
oh,
then
wow.
I just commuted for about 2 weeks and then I went back down. So when I first came to D.C., I was working at First Focus, which is an advocacy organization. It's part of America's Promise, which was founded by Colin Powell.
Mm-hmm.
And they lobby Congress to put children and families at the front of their budget. And when I was working there, I worked primarily on child care, early childhood education issues, and foster care issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved into a new role there as the director of public engagement, where, oddly enough, I worked in social media.
Wow.
Portraying how do we get the messages across. We worked in very complex issues, and how do we explain them very clearly to people who might be interested but may not otherwise understand them or would know that they were even happening.
Right.
So.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you say commuted, did you just like move your stuff here and then just go back for the last 2 weeks? And
no. So I had come down for a conference, so I had stayed in a hotel room, and then I had come down to testify before Congress. And then a few days later, we had a White House event because it was National Foster Care Month.
Mm-hmm.
So I had just been moving back and forth between hotels and mm-hmm. moving to DC, going back to Connecticut. And then I moved back down full time.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, thanks. And other than that, I've just been advocating in my free time for child welfare reform.
So what is that?
Child welfare reform?
Yeah, just making sure that all people have, all like foster care children are able to get welfare.
No, so child welfare refers to adoption,
mm-hmm.
foster care, kinship care, which is when somebody is being taken care of by a relative, like a grandmother. And it also encompasses some areas of juvenile justice because a lot of youth who end up incarcerated under the age of 18 are sometimes also involved in the foster care system or should be.
Mm-hmm.
And so working in that issue, also, you know, obviously making sure that children have safe and secure families to grow up in. But while children are in foster care, how do we get their basic needs met?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of issues in that community other than simply finding homes.
So, oh, wow.
So it's a really broad term.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is a lot to do.
For sure.
Cool.
Yeah.
I was just wondering what if that heat that just came on was controllable, but I guess I can't turn it off. But anyway. Okay. So I wanted to first, before we started, say that I talked, obviously, we're talking
sure.
because I talked about you in a previous podcast. So if anyone's listening to this, I think it probably would be beneficial because we're probably going to reference things mm-hmm. that I talked about in the other podcast. Probably be beneficial to maybe listen to that first. That was episode 26. But yeah, so the reason, so first I want to explain the reason as to why I wanted to do that, which I think I communicated to you
yeah.
a little over Facebook message,
sure.
but just for people listening, is, and it's also the reason as to why I wanted to have you on, was because you are someone who is within the Quinnipiac community, under the public eye. A lot of people knew who you were because you were very vocal about your opinions, and it led to a lot of controversy. And I just wanted to... To be honest, I genuinely thought you were an intelligent person and that you were coming from a good place and that you were attempting to do to actually like accomplish good
sure.
good things. But I guess I wanted to know. First of all, I wanted to know more about you. I wanted to be able to highlight some of the things that you're doing. But I also wanted to know what your intentions were, and I wanted to know what like your goal with everything is and like what the best way you think of going about what you're trying to do is. And for people who didn't listen to the first one, what she or at least from what I saw, what you're trying to go about to do is like speak out against social injustice, make sure, you know, there's social justice in the world, you know, speak out against intolerance. But so the reason I did, initially I asked you to come on the podcast, and then you decided that you didn't want to after telling me you did, and which is okay. You can do whatever you want. It's your decision. So that was me doing that was like a way of like, just being like, all right, you know what? I'm just going to tell her. I'm just going to put it all out on the table. I'm going to tell her everything I'm thinking so that maybe she can be like, oh, he doesn't have any like nefarious intentions. Sure. Like he's just trying to see where this girl, where you are coming from, mm-hmm. and get to know you better.
Yeah.
But anyway, and another thing, people may think like, okay, so what is so important about you specifically, what is so important about you individually? I think that like potentially a conversation we can have about all of this. Well, one, I think a lot of what I talked about was important to our peers, mm-hmm. important to Quinnipiac people. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people had opposing opinions about it. Some people had one opinion, some people had another opinion. Mm-hmm. So I felt like obligated to talk about it because I felt as if a lot of people who gave opinions maybe didn't have the forum or didn't have the platform to like do it in an effective way. Mm-hmm. And I felt as if, and I also felt as if a lot of the things that we could potentially talk about were relatable to our generation, yeah. in general. Mm-hmm. So that's why I wanted to have you on. But anyway, something I mentioned in the first podcast was about, and in wanting to find out what your intentions were mm-hmm. wanting to find more out about your past. Because obviously it's known within Quinnipiac and you've done a lot of good work for the foster care system. Sure. It's known that you were a foster kid yourself. Mm-hmm. But like I feel as if like a lot of people really don't know like what specifically happened. And I was interested in what led you to have to be into the enter the foster care system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could choose to talk about however much you want to talk about. Mm-hmm. But I was just wondering like where Lexi started, like where it originated, sure. like where were you born, like where you spent the most formative years of your life.
Yeah. So, well, I was born in New Haven, Connecticut.
Oh, really?
At Yale Hospital.
Yeah. No way.
And then I grew up in Meriden, Connecticut, which okay. is like two towns over from Quinnipiac. Mm-hmm. And so I speak very publicly about being in foster care. I don't really speak about my life before foster care, mm-hmm. not because it was like so traumatic and so horrifying, but because I feel like that story involves people other than myself.
Right.
And it's sometimes not appropriate to speak about things that sometimes other people may not want people to know, or mm-hmm. they may feel differently about it. So I lived in Meriden until about I was 14. And then I went into the foster care system. And at that point, I moved to Hartford. Mm-hmm. To West Hartford, where I went to high school at Hall High.
You went to high school Hall High?
Yeah.
So you entered the foster care system at 14?
Yeah.
Is that like older than most people who enter the foster care system? Because you can't...
Yeah.
Because you can't enter foster care... You can only... Like, once you're older than 18, you can't, right?
Yeah, and I mean, in some areas, if you're 16, 17, at that point, you're old enough to emancipate yourself. So they really wouldn't bring... Emancipate would mean that you can go to court and petition to become a legal adult.
Right, right, right.
Be on your own if you're 16.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some jurisdictions, they won't even let you go into foster care. So 14 is older, but it's not uncommon for older people to go into foster care. Mm-hmm. But the odds of you finding, you know, permanency... What we say permanency is just, you know, family that you could stay with,
mm-hmm.
Either foster or they'll adopt you,
mm-hmm.
becomes very unlikely.
Okay. Well, so you've publicly said that you chose to be homeless in order to be able to attend high school. Like, what does that mean?
That's like, and that's something that I think I've talked about a lot, and it's very confusing.
Yeah.
So when I entered foster care when I was 14, so to clarify, I was never up for adoption. I never wanted to be adopted. My parents' rights were not terminated. So when I entered foster care, I had been staying with an uncle, mm-hmm. right? And I was staying with my sister, and we were supposed to stay there. And you know, after a few months, there was a waiver issue where there weren't enough bedrooms, right? And this is what I actually had to testify about recently, about the waiver issue. Mm-hmm. So they could have made a waiver for me to stay in the home, but they chose not to. In my opinion, it was because of laziness, and it would have taken more work for them.
Huh.
So
pure negligence.
Sure. I mean, you know, I could have stayed there if they had wanted to make it work. Mm-hmm. But I think social workers are overburdened, and sometimes people just don't want to give it all, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was moved to a shelter in Hartford, Connecticut, a youth shelter, which was obviously very rough. And I could have gone to or sought out long-term foster placements. But in order to stay in the same high school that I started in, I had to be legally homeless. And that's because there's a law called the McKinney-Vento Act, which provides money for students to be transported to their school of origin. So let's say I'm with my parents, right?
Mm.
I start at Hall High School. That's my nexus because my parents pay taxes in that jurisdiction. Well, then I become homeless. Well, Hall High School is still my nexus high school. Mm. And if I become homeless again, I'm not establishing a new school of origin.
Oh.
But the money is who's going to pay to, the problem is who's going to pay to transport me to the high school. At that time, there was no law in place, no federal law, that would mandate the Department of Children and Families to provide funds. So the really the issue came down to money.
Right.
Yeah.
So choosing to be homeless is something different than choosing to be in the foster care system. You had to choose to exit the foster care system?
I was still in foster care.
Okay.
But I stayed in...
So how was that different than you, than what it was previous? Choosing to be homeless, like, what was that situation for you? Like, did you live on the street? Like,
no, I think... And what's so interesting is there was actually a lot of foster youth who stay in emergency and transitional shelters.
Mm-hmm.
People don't really know about that. That's not something the public really knows about. But especially for teenagers, you know, there's transitional shelters and the Department of Children and Families, which is the government agency that oversees foster care, mm-hmm. will reserve a certain number of beds for kids that are in foster care that just don't have anywhere else to go. In some jurisdictions, I think Texas comes to mind as one that does this, they'll actually let kids stay in the offices overnight because there's just nowhere for kids to go.
Oh, wow.
So you can either, well, I mean, obviously the difference is, you know, you're at a shelter. There's a lot of transition, people coming in and out. There's a lot of people coming in from prison. Girls that have just been released from a juvenile, you know, detention facility and don't have anywhere to go may stay there. People can come off the street sometimes. So, you know, you're dealing with that kind of issues that come with that. And the lack of security. When you're in a shelter, you know, you may not be able to stay there the next night. Because there's time limits on your placements, you're dealing with a lot of insecurity there.
Wow.
Sure.
So you were able to go to high school, get an education.
Yeah.
So that was what eventually enabled you to be able to go to college.
Sure. Yeah. And that was that was the goal.
Cool.
Yeah.
So was it tough? Like, what was some of the daily struggles of balancing school, making sure you're focusing on your education, and also like dealing with all that other stuff?
You know, I think the toughest part, so the high school I went to in West Hartford is a really nice town. It's where the governor lives. Apparently Tom Brady may move there because Eastman's right next door.
Moving on up.
So I was going to school with people that could never understand what I was going through. And I completely lied about everything.
Really?
I didn't tell a single soul that I was in foster care or that I was living in a shelter because I was so ashamed and I had no idea what my friends would think about me. And so my sophomore year, I had the opportunity to meet Elizabeth Edwards, who was the wife of John Edwards, who was running for president.
Oh, wow.
I met her while she had breast cancer, and it just been revealed that it was terminal and that her husband had cheated on her and fathered a child with another woman. And I met her the day after I had moved into my first foster home. And I had said to her, I said, you know, I'm going through a lot in my life and nobody knows, but you're going through a lot too and everybody knows. And what is the benefit of that?
Mm.
And she said to me, well, when people know, you can share the burden.
Mm.
But like, I kind of sat on that for 2 years until
it's hard to make that first step.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And my senior year, she died. And I remember thinking,
oh, wow,
well, yeah. Like really reflecting on what she told me. And I had just wrote this essay, very metaphorical, but about my experience in foster care. And I told my English teacher, I said, I want to read this in front of the room.
Mm.
I had like a lot of good friends in that class, and they had no clue I was going to do it.
And no one knew at this point.
And no one knew. And I just got up there and was shaking and trembling and read it. And
wow.
I feel like that was kind of my coming out of the closet.
Yeah. What was the reaction?
I think a lot of people were very shocked. I was a really high achieving student. And I don't think people would have assumed.
Were people eventually accepting?
No one was ever
openly not accepted.
Oh, no. And I don't think anyone was behind closed doors either.
Yeah.
And what I realized, there's a lot of people with messed
up
lives.
How do you not be? It's not like it's something like, you know?
Yeah. I mean, people were very kind and
mm-hmm.
and understanding. And I learned that there were some people that I had known that had a lot more messed up lives than I did.
Right.
You know, so.
Yeah. Yeah, once sometimes when you're the first person to speak out about like what is something that you within yourself see as something that's hard to talk about, when you're the person who does that, sometimes right away people will come up to you and then open up about. So that's cool that you took that step, and even though it definitely was hard, but but anyway, so you went to high school. How did you choose Quinnipiac? Like what eventually led you to go there?
Yeah. So my entire life, I've been very interested in math and science. I was on the math team when I was younger, and I've always been interested in the brain. Mm-hmm. So I originally wanted to become a pediatric neurologist. So I had looked at Quinnipiac because I had looked at Trinity for their neuroscience program, but I felt like it was too small. Quinnipiac also had a neuroscience program and a really good biology program, and I thought it'd be a good fit.
Mm-hmm. So besides wanting to get that education upon attending Quinnipiac, what were you hoping college would be for you? What did you want out of like a college experience going into it right before the summer before freshman year? What was Lexi's headspace?
You know, I think at that point I was just kind of happy to have somewhere to stay for 4 years and not move. That was where I was really excited about.
Wow, yeah.
And just all the opportunities to be able to meet cool people. And I don't think I had any real set expectations. I was really excited about decorating my dorm room, though. I remember that.
Yeah. It's so weird going into college, what you think it's going to be for you, and coming out realizing that what it was so different than what you expected to be.
Yeah.
But anyway, so now... You're almost a year out of college. We both are.
It's so
how do
easy.
You? Yeah, I know, right?
I know.
It's 23 is the first year where you start to, or I guess 22 years old is the first year where you start to wish that you were not getting older.
Right. I know.
It's crazy. But so now being almost a year out, how do you view your college experience now?
You know, I think a lot of people ask me if I could have gone somewhere else. Would I have gone to another school? And I would say no. I think I value my experience at Quinnipiac. I mean, especially like in terms of academics and the political science program, like the opportunities that the students have there to learn outside the classroom, I think is just like unparalleled.
So how did you transfer to political science, or why did you?
Freshman year when I was picking my courses, they told me that I couldn't take physics until like later on as an elective, but I really loved physics.
Right.
And I was just so distraught. And my whole life, I've always been actually very interested in politics and law. But everyone had always discouraged me from doing it. And then and I was sitting there. I was like, you know what? I'm going to go into poli sci.
Mm-hmm. So, sorry, continue. How do you view your college experience now? You were talking about what it gave you.
So, I mean, I think it made me who I am. I obviously, in terms of the academics, I gained a lot. I use those skills every day in my job. And I think in terms of, you know, the social aspect, the social justice aspect, I learned a lot about myself and about my identity and who I am. And I really value that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, all right. So what I'm trying to get at is, and before I say anything, I'm going to try to be as transparent with you about like opinions I have, things that are just my opinions. And I could beat around the bush and try to ask questions in a way,
just be honest. Yeah,
that like may seem like I'm trying to walk a line between figuring out how to direct questions specifically at you and then also talk about what is beneath the meaning of those questions in a more general sense.
Yeah.
But like, I don't want you to think that like I'm assuming things about you if I ask a question.
No, I'm not. Yeah,
because all of it is even if I do have assumptions, that doesn't mean that I necessarily truly believe it. I don't know if anything to be completely true. You know what I'm saying? But what I was trying to get at is you've obviously expressed in the past that like college wasn't the easiest for you, wasn't the easiest experience. And you even sent me the
article.
The petition.
Yeah. Oh, the petition. Yeah.
Because about certain things that you viewed as injustices that happened towards you. Do you mind if I like read like just part of it?
Yeah, or I can just clarify it or like
yeah, well,
say it myself.
I'll just how about I just read the first paragraph and then you talk about.
For sure.
Yeah. So you do you want to talk about what the petition was first?
Sure. So the end of my senior year, after, you know, the Ferguson protest on the quad and this the controversy around the sorority event and just some other events that happened on campus, I was sitting with two of my friends, Italo and Iman, and we were just talking, you know, we're leaving, we're graduating seniors, and we had heard from so many younger students that they didn't feel comfortable or sometimes even safe at Quinnipiac, and thinking, what can we do as our last thing to make this a better place for those students? So we worked with the Office of Multicultural Engagement, which is totally not the name. It's Office of Global Engagement.
They changed the name.
And Professor Sujata, we worked with her and some other staff to create a proposal to improve the campus climate for underrepresented students, which would mean minorities, but also LGBT, first generation, foster and homeless, just using our own experiences and, you know, what we heard from other people. And we're able to sit down with Mark Thompson and present that to him.
So within the petition, you and who, Italo, and who was the other person?
Iman?
Yeah, you both offered experiences that happened to you where you felt as if you were not represented, or you were devalued, I guess.
Sure.
So the first thing you wrote is it did not take about your personal experience. It did not take me long to realize that I did not fit in at Quinnipiac. Within the first several months of my freshman year, I had been called a spick several times. My peers often made jokes about my ethnicity. I remember in one instance, a student asked me how many people I could fit into my car. The experience was very painful and emotionally draining. In order to fit in, I stopped speaking up against the microaggressions and biases on campus and left the Latino Cultural Society. I felt like abandoning my identity would improve my experience at Quinnipiac. So why do you think that, like, people did that? Was it just out of nowhere? And can you elaborate more on the people, on the,
sure,
like, the instances that happened?
I think the easiest way to put it is that I've never felt like a minority until I went to Quinnipiac.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm biracial. I'm white and Puerto Rican. I believe I look very white. I mean, I look a little Hispanic, but I'm passable. And I remember the first week at Quinnipiac, it must have been like the second or third day, I'd asked somebody, I said, ¿Dónde eres? Because he looked Hispanic. And he said, I'm not a spick.
Oh, wow.
And I had never actually heard that word used in that way, or like been talked to like that. I had heard the word spick in that context about two other times that first week. And that's
just unprompted, just
no,
like,
just like not even like,
yeah,
just like just used like that. And that to me was shocking, because I had never even had conversations where that word was even used.
Right.
And for context, that's like the N-word for
Hispanic
people.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think, you know, walking onto that campus and having that be your first experience was really shocking and jarring.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to say that it's unfortunate that that happened, obviously, and it's terrible that that happened. That wasn't something within the social circle that I surround myself with, which I tried to talk to. I tried to engage with as many people as possible. I wasn't like a small social circle, even though my senior year I really didn't go out that much because I was kind of done with it.
Yeah.
But I didn't experience people who were like that. But that doesn't mean that it could just because they weren't treating me that way, because I'm clearly a white person. But I'm not saying that people I surround myself with were secretly like that, but just not around me. But it surprises me that people were like that, and it sucks that people were like that. But I guess the question is how often, like, within those first few years, did you feel as if injustices were happening to you?
I mean, I think injustice would be kind of a...
Or not injustice, but like you were being treated unfairly, or you were being... Or people were being bigots towards you.
Or I think some of it wasn't even really just directed at me. It was just kind of like...
Stuff you saw people say in general.
Yeah, like this ignorance just kind of about the world.
And about them.
One of the things that always kind of shocked me was the way that people talked about New Haven and the way that they made jokes about, in my opinion, the human suffering that goes on in that city and the poverty. And these were people that then would go on a trip to the Dominican Republic and hold a black baby and said, I'm totally transformed. Then you come back and you make jokes about the black person in New Haven doesn't have food on the table or can't provide for their family.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it was just kind of like the selfishness that the world kind of revolved around them, which is understandable at 18.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I had come in with a different perspective, and I found that sometimes really irritating, especially when you're in class and you're trying to talk about, you know, in political science class, you want to talk about current events. People who just couldn't get outside of the world, the very small world they had grown up in, and open their minds up on a college campus. To me, that was really frustrating.
Did you see people voice those things through like social media?
Sometimes. I think people said them out loud more though.
Mm-hmm. And you just happen to be within the environment of being able to hear those.
Absolutely. And I think it's, I mean, I understand that people who grow up in small towns and come to a college
mm-hmm.
don't realize what they're saying is wrong. And so I have empathy for them. I mean, for example, people would say like, oh, that's so good. I mean, I can't even like recall how many times I was called ghetto, like my first year at Quinnipiac, which is so shocking to me because I don't think I'm ghetto at all. Mm. Like I've never been, I mean, I've lived in the ghetto. And was
what is
called,
even
like,
is ghetto? Like the Jewish ghetto in like, no, like in Chelsea?
Hood, like
yeah,
hood,
I know. I'm just saying ghetto is such like a broad term.
I mean, at that point I was like 95 pounds and like 5'5", like hood. I don't think would like describe me. But like I think that was so shocking the way that they saw me. They saw like my brownness first. And like that was like I could see that in the words that they used to describe me. And that was really shocking to me because I've never been treated that way.
Mm-hmm.
Or really seen in that way.
Yeah. It's I guess when you're going from high school to college, when it's a larger community, there's more likely of a chance for more people to be like that.
I mean,
saying that there was too many, that there was the, I'm not saying that like the amount of people who did that was like okay.
Sure.
Or that like that's justified. I'm not just saying like, oh, some people are just going to be like that and you just have to, you know, tolerate it. But yeah, I mean, yeah, that's terrible.
I think the thing that was most hurtful about it was that there was an underlying culture where those things were okay.
Mm.
And I think college is a place where people can make mistakes and be corrected.
You think Quinnipiac got a culture that like allowed those things to be okay?
Absolutely.
Mm. That's interesting. Because it's just from where I'm coming from is I spent time with people and staff members and faculty who like did not go for that type of shit.
Yeah.
Like orientation leaders and like SGA. Like although maybe we didn't do everything we could to make sure that the diverse voice or the minority voice was fully represented, no one was completely malicious. No one like had any malicious intentions towards people like that.
I've met very few malicious people at Quinnipiac.
Okay.
Like when I say like
so you think maybe the ignorance is not necessarily malignant. It's just pure benign ignorance.
Yeah, and I mean I've said things, you know, that I didn't know were wrong.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you say it, and then you're like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
Have said that. Someone calls you out, and you learn. And that's kind of what college is. Like, you're supposed to be able to make mistakes
mm-hmm.
and be corrected and learn. And I, from my perspective, I didn't feel like that was the case. And I think the other interesting thing is there's, like, this, like, from the students I talked to of color at Quinnipiac see my perspective, and the students who are not of color see your perspective. Why is that? We're engaging with the same people.
Right.
You know, so I think that's, and I'm sure the people that you're referring to are people probably I've worked with.
Mm.
So I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer.
I don't either.
Yeah.
But okay, so I want to give this some context. I want to transition to talking about some of the stuff that I talked about on the previous podcast and some of the incidents.
Sure.
Now, one of the incidents you talk about in the next paragraph of your petition, so I'm going to read that. If you don't mind. So it says, but after several years of being a victim of racism, I was fed up. I finally decided to speak up on March 1st, 2015. Theta, and which is a sorority, and SGA member Carly Veeding, who I'm going to have on the podcast eventually, I hope, posted an advertisement for a charity event held by Theta to raise money for court-appointed special advocates, or CASA. The advertisement played off the Spanish word CASA, and utilized a Mexican theme for their event in several ways, by writing Nacho Average Philanthropy, by naming their event Queso for Casa, by using a pair of maracas as a symbol, by employing stereotypical Aztec print. It should also be noted that the event served Chipotle, which is Tex-Mex, but was billed as Hispanic food by members of the sorority. Furthermore, members of the sorority traditionally dressed in Mexican costumes, such as sombreros and mustaches at the event. commented on the photo expressing concerns that the advertisement invoked cultural appropriation issues. I explained that I had attended this event in the past and that it was offensive. I then took my concerns to Twitter and tweeted that the poster and image, I tweeted the poster image and wrote philanthropy with a side of cultural appropriation and stereotypes, so shameful. Immediately, members of Theta Sorority began to say harmful attacks, both physically and digital, against me. Several members of Theta sent photos of tacos and other stereotypical Hispanic images to me via social media. By the evening of March 1st, I was being attacked on social media by members of Greek Life, particularly members of Delta Tau Delta, by orientation leaders and sitting members of the Student Government Association. Okay. You also said, I don't need to read this, you also said that it got covered by, which I talked about in the previous podcast, it got covered by a lot of news sources who were kind of like spoke out against you, like Total Frat Move and Total Sorority Move, that the articles kind of mentioned you by name and encouraged Greek Life members to harass me or harass you. You talked about how people talked about it on Yik Yak, which is an anonymous social media app where people said a lot of malicious and hurtful things against you. And so, yeah, I talked about that on the last podcast. So I guess how I want to approach that is so that was the first time in a while at college you decided to speak out against something that you saw as a social injustice?
I think that was really the first time. Like, I remember, like, at that, like, to that extent.
Right.
Like, I remember the December before that incident, I was sitting on the steps of the library with my friend Mike. And, like, all of a sudden, there was, like, these protesters on the steps protesting Ferguson. And I wanted to get up, but, like, I was so scared.
Right.
I didn't know how people would react to me. And then I watched the entire thing unfold where students of color were being told to burn down Popeyes. And at one point, like, a white student pushed, like, a black female. And I was, like, I was actually just scared to be part of it. But I felt so angry that I had to feel scared for that. And in terms of Theta, I think it should also be mentioned that I don't really agree with the concept of Greek Life for personal reasons. I just don't think there should be really gender-based societies and that those don't have any belonging on a college campus. So that kind of precipitates everything else, right? So right. then, and in terms of Theta, my kind of, my feeling towards philanthropy is a lifestyle. That every day I live my life to give to others. That does not mean for one day a year I go and serve at a soup kitchen to people whose names I don't want to know. To people that I have no interest in really investing in beyond being able to post on Facebook, I served at a soup kitchen today.
Right.
So but those kind of things frustrate me.
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from, but like, if you're in a sorority or you're in a fraternity, or most all the sororities and fraternities, or I think most of them in Quinnipiac, had a philanthropy that they devoted time to.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're college students with other things, so it's not like devoting time to that philanthropy is a full-time job. Like, I guess the requirement is to have like one event, to hopefully raise money for that philanthropy and for that cause. I think it isn't really fair to assume that they are just doing it because they have to and that they don't actually care about.
Oh, no, I think they care.
Because when you said that when you said they don't really care who they're serving to or like what the cause is.
Well, and so for some context, you know, I've always been involved with getting prom dresses for girls that are in foster care. A lot of girls can't afford prom dresses. Almost every year that I was at Quinnipiac, I don't know if I did it my freshman year, but I know sophomore, junior, and senior year, I would reach out to a member of the sorority and say, hey, we have this prom dress drive. Would you at all be interested in giving away? No. Or talking to other members, just kind of one-on-one, not like a general kind of thing, saying, oh, you know, we have this foster parent recruitment, or we have this table at a college event where we're going to talk about Quinnipiac. Would you like to come? No. But you want to throw, you know, have a party and raise money, which is fun, but you want to make a long-lasting investment and really see these people face-to-face? The answer is no. And at one point, one girl told me, no, we can't do that, and they would give me different reasons. They were all just kind of crap because it shows me you haven't even looked into it. The other thing that I found was frustrating was the people who didn't even know what CASA stood for.
Right.
I mean, the majority of people that I talked to in Theta thought that CASA meant home. CASA does not mean home in this context. CASA means court-appointed special advocates.
Right.
When I asked them what the purpose of a CASA was, they told me that the purpose of a CASA was to get a child home.
Right.
But in fact, that's actually not always the purpose of a CASA. I had a CASA that helped me maintain educational stability while I was in foster care.
Do you think that the organization, or do you believe, or do you know if the organization chose to try to make the acronym CASA because CASA means home in Spanish, and a lot of people who are in the foster care system are Hispanic people? Was that their intent to like have that be like a kind of like a double entendre, or is it just like a coincidence?
Well, I'm almost certain that it's not court-appointed special advocates are not just for foster kids.
Oh, really?
No. See, it's just a general, people can have a court-appointed special advocate to petition on their behalf. So the difference would
be... But isn't it for foster care people? Isn't it for people in the foster care system?
Is for children involved in the child welfare system, but the concept of a court-appointed special advocate is not simply for foster kids.
Okay.
Yeah.
But
that's a good question,
though. Yeah, yeah. But I was just wondering if like that was if they attempted to do that because you're advocating for people, or not exclusively, but mostly advocating for people who don't have homes.
Well, no, that would actually that wouldn't be true.
Oh, so what is it?
Well, you're advocating for children who are in the foster care system, which means they might be with a foster family, they might be with grandma or grandpa.
Okay.
They may be returning home to their biological parents. They may not be.
Okay.
They may be seeking adoption. They may be seeking emancipation. Okay. There's a wide variety of needs, which I thought, that's why I thought it was interesting when I would sit down with these people and have a conversation. Well, what are you raising money for? Mm-hmm. What are you advocating for? You can't even tell me the name.
Right.
You can't even tell me what the organization does.
Mm-hmm.
To me is offensive because when I was in foster care, I had a lot of people who would raise money for the shelter I lived at or organizations I was involved in, and they never once wanted to know my name. And that has always stuck with me in the work that I do. I want to know the name of the people that I serve, at least one. I want to be able to sit down with them because it makes you feel like a prop, even if that's not their intention.
So you think it's offensive when people are unaware fully of who they're giving back to and why?
Yeah, because then why are you doing it?
Well, if you've been told that it's going to a good cause, even if you don't take the time to like fully research like what the cause is or like the ins and outs of it is, it's offensive that like to not take the time to fully research.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't know if that in that context if it would be offensive.
Because I mean, I understand people just being like, okay, this is what my sorority does.
Yeah, yeah.
They've been told me that this goes to people who need it.
Yeah.
So.
And I think that's like kind of
not saying that they shouldn't take the time to research, but I mean, I don't know necessarily if I consider it to be offensive that they wouldn't take the time.
Well, I don't know if that would be offensive. I think that would, to my opinion, kind of just be lazy activism.
Right.
Someone told me this is going to a good cause and I'm going to sit and I'm going to stay at, man the nacho stand.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there was more education that went on.
Mm-hmm.
But from my conversations with leaders of that sorority, especially around this incident, I was blown away by how little education they had on this topic and how little they knew about the organization. And I don't fault the members of the sorority at all for that. Because there are faculty advisors and adults that are supposed to lead these students. If I was in a sorority that was doing, raising money for kids in the Dominican Republic and I didn't know about it, and who knows, I might do the same thing, right? So that's why I kind of say like there should be that education in place that you understand the issue that you're raising money for,
That's interesting. I never considered that, actually.
And I think that's kind of another thing that I saw at Quinnipiac was like this, I guess I would call it slacktivism. Mm-hmm. Right. There were students, the big day where people would do that one day of service and the big event. They would go and rake leaves. And that's kind of what we talked to Mark Thompson about. And he agreed. He said that's like philanthropy. It's a lifestyle of always giving back when you can, when you have an opportunity to do so, not simply on one designated day.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's students that do that.
Mm-hmm.
But for a lot of students, the big event is that one day.
Mm-hmm.
Or there is these trips where people would go to third world countries serve for 5 days and hold someone's child and post their child's picture on the internet and say, I'm transformed.
Mm-hmm.
But are you?
Right.
What did you do? You did good work for 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
And not really understanding that. I think that is really slacktivism.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was frustrating to me. The reason I spoke out about this as opposed to that is because this is something that I work in,
mm-hmm.
and this was an organization that I was involved in.
Right. So it hit home.
It hit home.
So, I mean, I'm just trying to understand because, like, that means from what I'm understanding about, and then I kind of want to move into something else, but from what I'm understanding, you're saying that when people only occasionally are active, when people are only occasionally attempting to give back, you think that they should do that more so? You don't like when people just make it a not so often occurrence?
Well, I think the difference is your heart in it.
Mm.
And I know if your heart's in it, if you can tell me the name of the charity, if you can tell me what the charity does. And people just don't have a lot of time. Like, I understand people can't be doing it all the time. I know I can't with my schedule. But to have your heart in it and to be authentic in the work that you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm the reason I'm saying this is because I don't think it's fair to assume that everyone who participated, or even like some of the people who participated in the big event, weren't doing it for the right reasons or doing it with a good heart. Were you saying that you think they did? They were just like doing it to do it?
No, I think it was. I think some people had good intentions, but I think that we have to have more than just one day.
Right.
Yeah. It shouldn't just be like a one designated day that we go back and out and serve the community. Everything that we do in the community serves the community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are kids. I mean, I know people that served in the big event that then caused wreak havoc in the town of Hamden.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you can't have that one designated day. I'm going to do a good.
That doesn't erase all the other bad.
Exactly. It's kind of living your life to give back, which is very different than simply the act of volunteering.
Right. Okay. So, because I want to make sure that we're not going too long, based on everything we just talked about, the incidents that I talked about in my other podcast, I kind of readdress them within mm-hmm. that petition. It's obvious that you're someone who's interested in speaking out for social issues, right? And that you're kind of continuing to do work around that subject now. And like you said, you're a political science major. What propels you, or what began to propel you earlier in your life, and what continues to propel you to do this type of work?
I just think it's a natural inclination.
Mm-hmm. That's,
yeah, I mean, I was just kind of like,
you just feel obligated, part of your nature.
I just feel like it's kind of just who I am.
Mm-hmm.
I've always kind of been that way. Like, mm-hmm. it's not like there was like an initial incident or like anything. Because you had like asked, like, you had sent me that question. And, like, mm-hmm. I really thought about it. And I was just like, no, I just think it's kind of.
Yeah.
You know?
So, yeah, the question I'm talking about is, I mean, and if this is so, you don't have to talk about it specifically, but there weren't any injustices that happened to you firsthand that inspired you to be interested in doing work involving social issues?
No, I just
no
kind
way
of
that you were mistreated or like felt like you were underrepresented or devalued. That
no,
because the only reason I'm trying to infer that is because, like you said, in college, and I don't know if it happened to you before college, people were malicious towards you. People called your names. So like what I would project is that could inspire you to speak out against people who are like that, people who are intolerant. You know?
No, and I think it's interesting because, like, you're not the only one that said that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I've heard that before.
And I talked about my podcast is like sometimes the reason people are compelled to do that is because they came from a past where they felt like they didn't have any power. They felt powerless, and they feel compelled to speak out to have like a sense of power and to be liberated.
No, I mean, I don't think I've ever felt powerless
mm-hmm.
in my life. I mean, obviously, my childhood, I didn't really feel powerless. But I think even when I was a little kid, like when I would see people being bullied, like that was something I could not deal with.
Right.
So that I think, like thinking back to then, to like elementary school to kindergarten, when I saw someone being picked on,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't just stand by.
Right.
You know?
So to kind of be able to speak out for social issues, you need to know like what's right and what's wrong, kind of, you know, you need to know like what is, you know, like what things have you done to learn all the different types of cultures? I mean, I don't know if you've spoken out about anything that isn't involving things that are relevant to you, like you said, the foster care system or being a Latina person. What have you done to be able to like understand, you know, what is an appropriation or what is a stereotype or an inaccurate representation
yeah.
of a specific culture or what an inaccurate representation of a specific culture would be.
So when I was at Quinnipiac, I was also, I was like a few classes short of being a women's studies major, so I can't claim it.
Right.
But in my women's studies classes, that was a lot of the things that we talked about, the intersection between gender and race and class and those kind of things. So those were topics that we talked about really in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like I just somehow heard about it and found it interesting and researched it, but those were things that I found really interesting. And obviously, then tried to identify that.
Because what I'm referring to is that incident of the case of her CASA poster.
Sure.
I didn't know that any of that was a cultural appropriation. I didn't know that maracas were a stereotypical representation of Mexican culture. I didn't know that saying that it was Mexican food when it was really Tex-Mex food would be considered to be an offensive thing. So is that just something you, from being a Latina person, you knew?
Well, I mean, I think to say that, is it or is it not?
Right.
Well, I thought it was.
Right.
But you don't.
I'm not saying that I don't. I'm just saying I didn't know.
But it may not for some people.
Right.
And that's the point of having the conversation
with
topics like this. There isn't a concrete yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
I had been exposed to certain literature and research, certain set of ideas that led me to seeing it in that way. But perhaps somebody else may have been exposed to something else and then seen it and not think it is cultural appropriation.
Right.
And I think that they have a right to... I mean, I wouldn't say that there's a concrete yes or no.
So that's interesting. That kind of gets to what my overall, I wouldn't say intention, but what I'm trying to get out of this is, obviously when you speak out in social media like you do and you give your opinion, you're trying to educate people, right? What is your intention? What are you hoping will be accomplished? What's the mission?
Well, when I share on social media, I almost always say, when I post something and I want to hear other thoughts, I like to have discussions. I like stuff like
this. Do you
this.
Always?
I think sometimes I can get a little bit annoyed.
Right.
I think everyone does.
Mm-hmm.
But I do. And I think, I only delete comments on my posts when somebody might attack somebody else or is just trolling. When somebody comes out with the memes, then, it's ended.
Right.
But I think to educate... I think one thing that really surprised me was how seriously people took my opinions at Quinnipiac.
Why is that surprising?
Because...
When you're a defiant person...
Yeah.
When you... This is just my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
When you come off in a way where you're really sure, you have a true conviction.
Yeah.
You really are... Feel you're coming across as if you really believe as to what you're saying to be the right thing. You'd be surprised that people would take you seriously?
Because I feel like I have so many other friends at Quinnipiac that were so similar to me that nobody ever really talked about what they thought.
Right.
For the proposal, what was really interesting for me during that whole experience was I did not author that by myself. In fact, I would probably say I did the least amount of work on that. And the other two co-authors wrote about it on social media almost daily, and they were in the Chronicle about it, yet not one single person made a comment about them.
Well, I think by that time you started to get a reputation.
Sure.
I remember something happened during freshman year where something to do with the buses, and you said something about a contract and how they wouldn't... Remember when people were peeing on the buses? Yeah.
Oh, people God. I don't even remember.
People were peeing on the buses, and I think Mustafa, who's a past guest, utilized Facebook to say, hey, this is what... This is what administration told me, that if we continue to pee on the buses, they're going to cancel your contract. And you said, people can't do that. You can't just cancel a contract. So I think maybe the reason people responded to you
was
on
that
social
freshman year.
It was freshman year.
Wow.
Yeah, that was I think the first time I kind of heard about you through that.
Wow.
Yeah. So then I think people started to be oh, I think people started to be who is this? She's a person who gives what she believes to be is a true conviction, a true belief,
Yeah.
But so I guess we're getting at like you said, you ask for other people's opinions, right?
Yeah.
So when you voice your opinion on issues that could be polarizing or on social media could be obviously could cause hostility or disagreements, you kind of talked about before you speak out about a social issue, what thoughts do you have about the most effective way to go about making sure that people that it will have a positive effect on people, like a successful effect on people, that people will be educated, that people will, maybe people kind of will like let their guard down and not necessarily stick to what their belief was if it was one that was opposed to yours, and see your opinion.
Sure.
And try to actually internalize it instead of just be combative against it.
Well, you know, there's three different kinds of people. People who you already agree with, mm-hmm. they already agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
People who will never agree with you, and people who you can change. So right. I think I try to focus on that.
Do you really think that there's people who will truly 100% stick to their beliefs no matter what?
I think there are people who... Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think there are people who, you know, obviously at Quinnipiac, who have ideas about who I am as a person.
Right.
Who, you know, I've never met, who, you know, I could say anything and, you know,
yeah.
they would just not agree with me.
Right.
You know, for whatever reason they have.
Mm-hmm.
You know. 'Cause I don't think that's the entire student body, though.
Right.
Yeah.
So the reason I ask that is because I guess the point I'm trying to get across is my opinion that to most effectively educate someone in a way that maybe they haven't thought of previously, to make sure to really effectively kind of communicate your opinion to someone else or to a large group of people, especially in social media where people only see the words.
Yeah.
I think it's imperative to really kind of exhibit that you are accepting of what the other side of the argument may be, or that you, not even accepting, but like that you acknowledge it, that you understand it's there. Maybe you, like I said on the other podcast, you empathize with where the other people are coming from. And I think that some of the criticism that you got is that oftentimes when you gave your opinion, you kind of were critical of people who didn't necessarily agree with you, or you belittled people who didn't necessarily agree with you, and made people feel ashamed, like when you say, or when, not you say, but when anyone says that that's shameful, or that it's a shame that they think the way they think, kind of makes people retreat back into their own original belief, because, you know, they're like, why would someone make me feel bad about what I believe? Shouldn't they like understand where I'm coming from? So I think that maybe, it's my opinion that the best way to communicate and educate is to be open and to show that you're open.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Funny enough, I think a lot of my friends at Quinnipiac weren't on my side during that.
Right.
They didn't agree with what I thought, but they were still my friends, and I was still their friend and respected that they didn't mm-hmm. necessarily think that it was cultural appropriation. That mm-hmm. was never like a big argument between me and them, that I saw it one way and they saw it the other.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the event with that poster, I don't think those girls, if they had known that it might be inappropriate, mm-hmm. would have done it. Like, I think that was just something that they
exactly.
thought was cute, and
mm-hmm.
I mean, in the past they had like done sombreros and stuff. So like that, like then other people were like, "Well, why did you wait till your senior year?"
Mm-hmm.
And it's because like I got fed up after 4 years, not solely of the sorority though, of like other things that were going on campus involving grades. To me, this was like seriously, and not that this was like the worst mm-hmm. either though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just people trying to do something cute and they didn't know.
See, and that's the thing. In the other podcast, I said that sometimes I feel as if when you gave your opinion, you were disrespectful. In that instance, I don't even really think you were that disrespectful. I don't even think you were that disrespectful at all, to be honest.
Well, I respect Carly, and I know that Carly wouldn't have gone out of her way to do something that would be
mean, but that's the thing. When you commented on it, you only said, "This is wrong because of this." You weren't necessarily belittling them.
No.
You didn't like say, "Oh, like this is a shame that you would do this." You didn't say it in that instance. You said it. You tweeted it. Philanthropy with a side of cultural appropriation, so shameful. But when you commented on the Facebook, you didn't shame them for, you know, not knowing. But you didn't necessarily say, when you communicated, you didn't say, "I understand maybe you didn't have malicious intentions. I understand maybe this is just benign ignorance." You know what I'm saying?
Well, because that has to be implied, though. Like, I think...
How is it implied, though? People may just think, like, that you just think that they're being ignorant in a mean way, which is what I thought.
You thought that?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, I think for me, I thought it was...
And it's what I think a lot of people thought.
I thought it was... That's interesting. I thought it was so obvious. I guess the reason I didn't say it is because I thought it was so obvious that they weren't purposely trying to use someone's culture, or they purposely didn't, you know, they weren't going out of their way.
And it isn't even about like that they were purposefully appropriating culture. It's what their intentions were. It's, I understand that you weren't intending to be mean about it, that it isn't coming from a mean place. It's just coming from ignorance that isn't necessarily malignant.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I just thought that was so obvious that I didn't feel to point that out.
But don't you think that the most effective way to educate people, do you agree that the most effective way to educate people about their ignorance is to make people aware that, like, I understand that maybe you aren't coming from a bad place, but this is what I think, instead of just saying what you think, making sure that people know?
I mean, I think that's certainly like an interesting point.
Mm-hmm.
I had assumed that they would know that I didn't think they were trying to be mean because it was just a cute poster for a...
Right.
Like a vet, you know, selling nachos. So, I mean, I thought that it was kind of implied, but I think that's...
But do you think that maybe, like, the reason why that whole thing blew up the way that it did is because people didn't assume that you assumed that they weren't trying to be mean?
I have no... Honestly, I don't know why it blew up like that. That might be an element for some people.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the overall question is before speaking out about something, do you attempt to determine whether an appropriation of culture is malignant? It's like disseminating or propagating like hurtful ignorance into the ethos. Like it's reinforcing ignorance that comes from like a cruel place, or do you attempt to determine whether it's coming from a place that's like benign ignorance? And if so, how do you handle those situations differently?
Well, I don't think you can really change someone that's coming from a bad place.
Right.
Like the kid that called me a spick.
Right.
I walked away.
So that's interesting. So maybe anytime you speak out against something, it's when you think that it's coming from not a bad place.
No, I don't. I go through life. There's people who think the world is all bad and all good. Well, I generally think people are all good, although there's some bad people.
Right.
But that people generally make mistakes that come from... They don't mean to make that mistake.
Right.
But no, I don't think that most people, you know, are coming from a bad place. And I think that if there is that kind of, you know, coldness in their heart, I don't think I could change that.
Right. So if you speak out against someone and you don't think it's coming from a bad place, like take example, that orphans video thing, you were kind of harsh. Like you like said that it was disgusting. And you said that, I don't know the actual word you said that it, you were ashamed that they would do that, and that it was used a lot of words that were like, you know, disgusting,
sure.
Harsh, whatever.
Strong language.
So if you were speaking out against that, and maybe did you think that they were coming from a bad place or just a place of benign ignorance? And if so, if it was coming from benign ignorance, like I'm just trying to understand like why it would be effective to, if the overall goal is to be like, hey, my opinion is that this is offensive.
Sure.
I'm trying to educate you on that. Why? Kind of, I just don't want, I think some of the problems, and I'm not saying it's with you exclusively because I don't think you always do this, but I think a lot of the problems with our generation about people who speak out for social issues is they feel as if when people are being intolerant, they respond by bullying as well. They bully back. They stoop to their level. So I'm just wondering if you ever consider like, okay, maybe they aren't trying to be, maybe this isn't coming from a bad place, and if you don't think it is, how you handle those situations differently, or like why you handled that situation the way you did.
Well, I thought I was, I mean, just like, you know, for background, I found out about it because the student that I mentor at Quinnipiac is in foster care and called me crying.
Really?
Really upset about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I heard about the video and then saw it on Q30, or it was Q30, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because Students and Parents Weekend is the hardest time on campus for students without families, particularly students whose parents have actually, you know, passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And when he called me sobbing and saying, this is the hardest weekend, and basically the student that they're portraying is him, that made me mad because this is someone that I care about.
Mm-hmm.
When I saw that video, I think it was a poor attempt at a satire. I think if it was done well...
What do you mean by satire?
Trying to parody something, trying to make like a bigger point.
Because satire and parody are two different things. Satire is when you're like kind of A parody is like a replicating of something.
Yeah.
A satire is kind of just using humor to talk about like topical issues.
I saw it trying to be like a satire at first. I thought it was a failed attempt at a satire. I just thought like, all right, let's have a weekend about bringing parents.
Because the parents' weekend was a topical issue within the community, you're saying? So they're just trying to satirize.
Because that's what I was like, how else would you have a weekend about parents visiting their kids by making fun of or making a video about people who don't have parents?
Did you ever consider that they weren't trying to make fun of orphans, but they were just trying to kind of use the idea of orphans, people who have no parents, as a way to kind of go up to parents and like mess with them, and that the humor wasn't trying to be stemming from making fun of parents, but it was trying to just come from playfully messing with parents.
Well, that's
and
why
that
it failed.
Yeah, well, I mean,
it's almost like, let's say, well, let's have a video about refugees.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of like, I see where they were going with it.
I can understand that they didn't think like, oh, orphans would be hurt by this. You know?
Yeah, but like for me, it's like, is there like anyone that like oversees these videos? Like when I like think about...
No, to be honest, no.
Really?
I was in the late night talk show.
Yeah.
That they do have a set of guidelines where they try to make sure, or at least when I was a part of it, they had a set of guidelines to try to like, they wouldn't let me tell jokes about like things that could potentially be controversial.
Sure.
Which is obvious. So, I mean, I don't know whether or not they said, hey, I wonder if this will be offensive to orphans.
But just like students, like I just think like I would sit down and like with my friends and brainstorm and say, hey, like let's like make a video about like parents and families weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And then my other friend was like, yeah, let's do it by like all pretending that we're orphans without parents. And everyone was like, yeah, like wasn't there anyone mm-hmm. like in that group that was like.
Yeah, I bet you it stemmed from because I've done videos in the past where like. During tours, like I would pretend to be in the tour and like say like funny things that like people would be like, what?
Well, that's
so
funny.
So I think, so I think it kind of stemmed from like, oh, like what if we just like went up to parents and we're like, hey, we don't have any parents. Can you be my mom? Like not seeing like, oh, with the intention of like I said, oh, get the weird reaction out of the parent, not necessarily be like, oh, there's actually, I could see them being like, oh, I forget that there's actually students like this and that may bring up some bad emotions.
And that's the thing is, it's like you're a student,
but
in college, benign ignorance. But I think it's just shocking to me that this is a good school,
mm-hmm.
and that there are students who could all come up with this concept, and not a single person could come up with a better idea,
mm-hmm.
like or that someone wouldn't point it out. That to me is. But also, I'm coming from a different place where like I was that student,
right. So
I'm coming from a different lens,
right.
Maybe they didn't know anyone at Quinnipiac that didn't have parents,
yeah.
or a parent had passed away.
So I guess what I'm trying to get at is, you know, I've been trying to educate myself about, and Mustafa has too, we've talked about it before, a lot of these philosophical ideas and about like the history of philosophy. And there was something we learned about like this idea of tolerance, right? And, what tolerance means. And I guess what it means is, willingness to accept the opinions and ideas of other people, even if you don't necessarily agree with them, right? So I guess the question I have for you is like, how tolerant should you or should one be towards the beliefs that one or you may view as intolerant?
Well,
or like, what criteria do you use to determine how tolerant you're going to be towards a set of someone else's beliefs? Or what is the most effective way of communicating your intolerance towards beliefs that others have that you view as intolerance?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think those two instances, I wasn't really protesting the students' beliefs. I don't think any of
those
students...
Well, I'm not even
saying... Okay, I just want to clarify
that
I don't think any of those students, especially in the orphan video, like, I don't think...
But by making that... But it could be said that by making that poster, they believed that it wasn't offensive. So you are technically opposing what their initial belief was, obviously by making
the action.
Yeah.
But
the action is kind of beneath the action is like they're doing this because they didn't believe it to be offensive. So it's kind of an unanswerable question, but because you shouldn't be, if you're completely tolerant of everyone, like, okay, you can do that. You can believe that. I'm not going to do anything to kind of, you know, oppose that or speak out against it, eventually intolerance will overtake tolerance and we'll just live in a world where people are intolerant about everything. Mm-hmm. But if you truly are intolerant, or if you truly are tolerant of people's beliefs, there needs to be, don't you think there needs to be some kind of, like I said, some kind of meditation on, okay, I'm accepting of where this person is coming from. I feel inclined to speak out against it or to give my opinion that I am intolerant towards what I consider to be his intolerance. What is the most effective way of doing that and hopefully educate him that he is being intolerant?
Sure.
You agree? So I'm just saying, like, what, don't you agree that maybe showing that you're tolerant of their idea and showing that maybe that their ignorance isn't coming from a malicious place or a malignant place would be better than just giving your opinion exclusively?
Well, no, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, there's, you know, two examples of that on Facebook. I don't think that would be representative of, you know, how I would live my life or how I do live my life or how I interact with people and my job or and the issues that I work on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I understand that. It's just like I said in the past, we can move past this, but like I said in the past, I think a lot of the criticism you got was because people believe that you weren't necessarily accepting of the other side of the argument or of the place they were coming from. Not even accepting, you didn't acknowledge it and you didn't take the time to understand where they were coming from.
No, yeah, I appreciate this.
Yeah.
That's what I think was so interesting is like you had mentioned that people had come to you and said they felt some kind of way. What was so interesting is not like a single person came to me like this, like, hey, Lexi, like, I feel this kind of way, and here's why.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, wow, like, okay, that's great. Like,
yeah.
Now we can actually have a conversation.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what people actually need to do.
And I'm not saying that's a terrible thing. I'm not like, this whole point it may seem like I'm trying to criticize you, but I'm not. I'm trying to be respectful. But like, I just wanted to have a conversation about this because I think it's important for people here in our generation because people don't necessarily think about these things.
No, I think it's dope. Like, I love philosophy. Like, when I was in Quinnipiac, I was, like, in the philosophy society. And, I mean, I think it's great when people, like, see something that's interesting and controversial and say, I want to learn more.
Right.
Like, that's awesome. And I think more people should do that other than kind of just make assumptions, you know?
Right. So I guess the last a few last questions.
What if I text my ride real quick?
Yeah. A few last questions. And if you have to wait to answer, that's fine.
Okay.
A few last questions I have are, now, like, I've talked in the podcast I talked about previously, I wanted to know what your intentions were. And you said today that you just felt compelled to always do it. You always felt like you didn't like when people were bullied and you just kind of felt obligated to speak out against what you saw to be an injustice.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to talk about something that has to do with me is, like, you know, obviously anyone who wants to be a performer or an entertainer or a public speaker has an essence of, like, wanting to be heard, you know, feeling as if their ideas have worth, feeling. And, you know, I've said in the past on this podcast that, like, it's really hard for me to be heard. Like, it's hard for me to speak out because although I feel as if I do have opinions that have worth that should be heard and that I think I could be good at something like this, it is still paired with like a low self-esteem. So like, that's why I said in the past, but it does matter about me.
Yeah.
Is there any essence in you of like, besides completely caring about speaking out against things that you view as injustice of like, I think I'm right and I want people to see it. I want to be heard. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Because when you speak on, that's another thing that I think people were critical of is like when you speak out social media, and I talked about it, people do it because they want to be validated. People want their opinions to be validated and be like, oh, wow, she's a smart person. She has this really different and unique and intellectual opinion about this. So like sometimes I feel as if people in our generation speak out because they just want to be the person to have like an opinion that could be controversial. I'm not saying that you do, but do you have any essence of like, I want to be heard?
No. Like, I would have to say, if I wanted that, if I wanted that validation, I would have said things that I knew people at Quinnipiac would agree with.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have to say that sorority...
Not necessarily validation, but attention.
Well, if I wanted that, mm-hmm. I would have said things that would have been positive. Mm-hmm. Like that aftermath of that sorority controversy, I would have to say was the worst time in my mm-hmm. college experience. Like I was extremely depressed. Mm-hmm. I had somebody looking for my address and I had to have my friends stay over and security outside my apartment.
Was someone posted on Yik Yak?
No, and there was other forums as well, like International Journal. Joking? Somebody like was like, she lives in Hamden, here's her last name.
Wow.
I was like terrified for my life, actually.
That's
and, like,
fucked up.
It was really fucked up and it was extremely scary. And like looking back on that, like makes me sad mm-hmm. that I had to go through that shit. Mm-hmm. If like to think like, would I have done that? Or like, and I continued to speak out after that, mm-hmm. like about some things, not because I wanted that attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I thought those things were important.
Right.
Like with the proposal, that those were things that I had, you know, I felt like I had spent 4 years at a university where, you know, as a minority, I was, you know, I had to face challenges that were unfair. And that was really important to me.
Right.
And I mean, I knew that people were obviously going to say not like it, but mm-hmm. screw them. You know, like that was kind of my mindset is, you know, I think this is important and I'm going to work on it.
Right. Yeah, and I understand because you talked about how it was hard for you at first and then eventually you kind of like were fed up and then you were like, I want to speak out now, like I feel compelled to. But so there was no essence of like, I know that this is wrong and I want to show people that I know it's wrong?
Well, like to one-up them? I mean, what would be the point of that? I mean,
I don't know. That's why I'm asking.
No, I mean like... So,
because, I mean, people are competitive. People like want to show power, like it's a natural, sometimes a natural part of you. I'm not saying that you are like that. I'm just wondering because, like I said, I've assumed things and I want to know what the truth is, you know?
I'm thankful you think I'm Frank Underwood.
I don't think you'll kill people.
Yeah, right? No.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, right. Oh, that's not season four, right?
No.
Oh,
okay. Well, yeah.
Okay.
Even though I've seen season four, but okay. That's not what I was talking about.
No, I mean, I don't think that was it at all to like one up somebody or mm-hmm. like show somebody that like I know more than they do. Mm-hmm. Because it was, the other thing is this is something that I had learned in a class with like 19 other people. Like, I don't feel like this was like some like secret knowledge that like I had and was sharing.
Right.
You know? And I think that's like what surprised me most about the incident was like how much weight people had put into my opinion.
Right.
And that they would shut down an event over my opinion. Although I don't know if it was shut down over that. I think it might have been shut down mm-hmm. over the retaliation. But that somebody would value it that much. To me, it was kind of like one person.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so two last questions. That'll be quick. A lot of people, especially older generations, consider people in our generation to have a tendency to be overly sensitive about certain social issues. What are your thoughts on that? And do you think they have a point?
Oh, that's gonna be a quick question.
I mean, it doesn't have to be, but...
Yeah. I mean, no, I think that's really interesting. I think about that a lot. Like, I really do. And I think... Especially on college campuses mm-hmm. with safe spaces, because I'm torn. Right. You know, when I was in my classes, the classes where I learned the most were the most controversial classes. Like my first women's studies, were you in my women's studies? No, we
I was
had
in your
her
English with Kaplan.
English.
That was the worst class of my life. I know you loved her.
But I love her. Well,
she didn't like me though, that's why.
No, I had her first semester.
And I thought I was, I think I'm a good writer, and I did not do well in that class.
I know, but that was tough. It was tough.
The hardest, it was an English 201 class.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the hardest class of my Quinnipiac career.
Oh, no, mine too. Like,
crazy.
It was bad. But I had her first semester for women's studies, and we read stories about like rape.
Right.
And like some deep shit. And,
oh,
like,
she loved making everything about sex.
Oh, gender. Everything. And but like at first I was kind of like, whoa, this is like crossing. I mean, some stuff like seriously crossing the
line.
Yeah,
like Dracula biting into someone's neck and like how that's like representative of an orgasm. I was like, whoa.
Like,
I did
okay.
not see that. Yeah.
Like, yeah, like that's controversial and like mm-hmm. someone could have.
Not
gone,
saying it's wrong. I'm just saying.
No,
I never thought
like
of it that way.
Someone could, you know, make a hissy fit and go to like the administration and say, I'm offended.
Yeah.
But you know what? I learned more in that class than like mm-hmm. any other class that I did at Quinnipiac. And I don't feel like classes or like professors should not read certain texts because it might trigger somebody or make them offended.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think classes should be neutral places. That's one thing I do. I feel like I might agree with older people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I think their criticism is if we're so sensitive about everything, people won't have the ability to speak out in a way, have a conversation like this or speak out in a way about what they believe, because if someone believes something that may be offensive to someone else, it may compel them to not want to give their opinion because they think that, you know, people will be critical of it.
Or that they can be subject to violence. Or, I mean, because my favorite poet is Carl Solomon, who wrote Howl.
Right.
Which is my favorite, absolute favorite poem.
Mm-hmm.
Where was I going with that? Oh, the whole thing about freedom of speech. So I'm trying to create this event called Liberty in Literature, mm-hmm. where, like, my friends and I will, like, read poems or, like, banned books and then perform them around Washington. Because when I was in high school, I was a founding member of the First Amendment Club, which is, like, so ironic considering this whole conversation.
Yeah.
But we would literally just sit and read, like, controversial texts and, like, talk about them to mm-hmm. give them life again. No, and I think, like, if somebody can't sit there and, like, I read a banned book or I read Howl and, like, that bothers you, sorry. Like, I don't think.
Yeah. And I think that maybe people were critical. I think people associated you with that, of, like, silencing people and making people afraid to have, like, you know. And I'm not saying that that's what your intention was, because I don't think it is.
I think I'm a very, I think I come across as a very confident,
yep,
strong person. Mm-hmm. I think that might be also, like, cultural differences.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I think there are people who feel like when I sit in a room and I say something, they can be intimidated by that.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that I feel like I tried to be more conscious of afterwards, especially when I was in classes. Because mm-hmm. I didn't want someone to feel like I was judging them. I think that the way I come across is very strong.
Mm-hmm.
But I think at the same time, what's so interesting is that my friends at Quinnipiac who would say the same things, Emmanuel Nitolo, never once got the criticism that I got.
Right, right, right.
You know, I think there's also some of the things is, I think a lot of the girls at Quinnipiac wore pastel colors,
mm-hmm.
and I was the one that wore the red.
Right,
and
right.
And you get a lot of shit sometimes for being a woman that wants to wear red.
Yeah. Seeks tension, kind of. Or people think that.
No, I mean, I think people have gender stereotypes about a woman that in the way that she presents herself, mm-hmm. and that if I want to sit in a classroom and confidently state my opinion and say that I feel this way,
mm-hmm.
I don't think that's feminine,
right,
at all. And that's okay, because that's who I am. But there are people who would look at me very differently, who, you know, whereas Mustafa, who is an educated, very intelligent person on the student body, when he would present his opinion, mm-hmm. might be perceived very differently.
Right, right, right. So I think the overall essence of, like, what I was trying to get across is just that I think when someone gives their opinion when someone gives their opinion or when someone expresses intolerance towards beliefs that other people have that may be intolerant, I think it's, in order to educate, I think it's important to empathize with the intolerance. Don't you agree?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think there are certain, see, when you say intolerance, my mind always goes to, like, Donald Trump now. Could one be tolerant of someone that wants to reject Muslims?
But don't you understand where he's coming from? I'm not saying it's right.
No, but that's the.
But don't you understand?
That's the mental challenge, though.
And I'm not even the mental challenge. Yes, the mental challenge is okay. I understand that I don't think it's that challenging to understand, to try to understand where he's coming from. And I'm not. And to be honest, that's more complicated because I don't even know if he necessarily agrees with everything he's saying. Like, I think he's pandering to people who do believe what he's saying to try to instill fear in people. But that's another. But within those people who believe Muslims should be banned, I'm not saying it's right. But
you can understand where they're coming from
because they're afraid.
I know, but that's the thing. That's the mental challenge. Like, these questions are so easy, but they're so challenging and fun because then you get into, all right, I understand,
so,
but that's such an evil thing to say, but then...
So yeah, something that you perceive as evil as that, something even that evil, I think you should be like, if you're speaking out against it, I understand where you're coming from. I understand why you may have this opinion, but this is why I believe what I believe.
Well, no, but that's what you do in meetings, though. I mean, like, in terms of, like, being on the Hill... Like,
but on social media too, don't you think? Especially when people don't have tone of voice, people just have words.
Sure.
Don't you think you should try to utilize transparency as much as possible and show that you understand where they're coming from and respect where they're coming from, even though you may not fully respect it? Like, not even respect, but, like, acknowledge it. This is what we've been talking about the whole time.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think
even something as what you perceive to be as evil as that.
No, yeah, I mean...
If you were trying to educate people that you think they're wrong, don't you think it would be better for you to acknowledge their opinion?
Absolutely, but I think in those two instances, I think I was just so fed up.
Mm-hmm.
Especially like that sorority incident. After all that crap for 4 years, I was just like...
Yep.
You know, this is what it is.
Yeah.
You know?
Understand.
But I understand where you're coming from. I wonder if the reaction would have been very different if I had phrased it like that.
I wonder. I think it might have been.
You think it might have been?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was interesting. I just think the whole thing was interesting.
Yeah. Well, Lexi, I'm glad you came. Last question. What are your personal and professional hopes for the future? That's how I end every podcast.
Oh, for the future?
It could be short. It could be like, I want to have a kid and married and get a good job and have money. Sorry if I just answered the question for you.
I mean, like, yeah, that should be like, right? I don't know.
But it could be more specific if you want.
Go to law school, become a child advocate, you know, do good work and fight for what I believe in, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm glad we were able to have this conversation.
For sure. Thanks for coming down to DC.
Yeah. Hopefully, I'd love to hear about anything you do in the future.
Yeah.
So
I'm in a documentary that's coming out if you're into entertainment.
Yeah. Are you going to post about it on social media?
I absolutely will. I already did, but they keep telling me I have to post about the trailer.
Yeah.
I keep forgetting.
Yeah. Promoting yourself is a hard thing. It's something I'm not that great at with
this
podcast. No,
yeah. It's like so egotistical.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But thank you very much for doing this.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. All right, that was it. Thank you for listening. I hope you guys enjoyed that. I think that conversation was civil and that we got some good work done, personally, professionally. We got to see Lexi as a human being. I think we got to see what her intentions were. We got to see the real reason behind everything that I assumed. And I hope that people who maybe were wondering from the Quinnipiac community about why she did what she did or wondering where she was coming from now may have more of a full answer. So thank you to everyone who's listened. I am now going to get some food with Stav somewhere in Washington, D.C. Where are we going? We gotta use Yelp.
I don't know, but there's something called Yelp.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then maybe a movie?
Maybe. That was a bit feminine. All right. So, yeah, thank you to everyone who's listened. We'll have another episode next week. I did an episode with Stav and my past guest, Kyle Veltri. I now have technology where I can have three mics. So I utilize that. That'll be the episode you'll hear next week. But yeah, thanks for listening, everyone. Have a good week.